Hello, everybody. Welcome to a special broadcast of Beyond Awakening, The Future of Spiritual Practice. This is Terry Patton. I created and hosted this series, have hosted it now for 3+ years. For anybody who doesn't already know me, I'm the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author of Integral Life Practice with Ken Wilber. I created this series to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a deep public dialogue about how higher consciousness can play a key role in helping people rise to meet the current challenges of an unsustainable human presence on our planet and a benign transition. I've now held over 90 conversations on this topic. They're all available for free download once you've registered at beyondawakeningseries.com at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. And today, I'm joined by Tom Steininger. We're going to continue that discussion in a conversation about a conversation that we held just 11 days ago, which was titled My Guru Experiment. I highly recommend that you listen to that dialogue because it provides the context for what we're about to do now, including my full introduction to Dr. Tom Steininger, which I won't repeat today. Tom and I will dialogue for an hour or perhaps a bit more. We've gotten quite a few questions that I want to bring in already from listeners. If we get through all of that, and I hope we will, we'll make some announcements and spend some time taking live questions. We're planning to finish up in about 90 minutes, perhaps a little bit longer. Welcome, Tom.
Hi, Terry. Good to be with you again. It's great to continue our dialogue here.
Yeah. What we're doing is kind of unusual, holding a conversation about a conversation so soon after it occurred. And this was your idea, so why don't you begin by explaining what motivated you to suggest that we do this?
Oh, thank you. I mean, first, it is an important conversation. I think even with this conversation, we won't be at the end. As we talked about the last time, this is all about the experience of my experiment and not only my experience with Andrew Cohen as a guru. And also, in our last conversation, I felt there were parts that I really want to add to what I said, because I felt that it needs more of me personally, my personal experience that I didn't give enough. And also, I got a lot of different email feedback, people who said very positive things, but also critical. And one main thing is that people really want to hear more of my story and all of that, and my a personal how I'm dealing with this, and I felt they were right, and I felt we should add this, and that's the reason why I asked you if there's a chance to just continue that and go into these aspects that we maybe didn't cover enough the last time, and see if we kind of create a fuller picture this way.
Well, great. I have gotten quite a few comments and questions too, some of them challenging not just to you but to me. And I think it would be good if we can set a little bit of a context for this. And one of them is that for some listeners, it was completely opaque when we talked about Andrew's abuse. And I think that's a bit of a problem. I mentioned there were several books written about what people felt were his excesses. There's one list online that lists quite a few detailed, things about where things got super intense. Andrew was obviously a very demanding and sometimes even very harsh teacher. And the things that people have accused him of, and you know, seemingly with real some real basis, are physical abuse of various kinds, financial exploitation, interfering in people's lives and behaviors in terms of privacy and family and personal relationships and sexuality. emotional and psychological abuse and ostracizing and denying and discouraging students' freedom to leave the community. I want to make sure that that's clear to anyone who doesn't know that context. And yet, those things did not cause the directly, I mean, they may have been part of a whole pattern, but the it seems that what caused the collapse and Andrew's taking the sabbatical was something else. And I'd like to give you a chance to explain a little bit of something, just an orienting initial statement about this whole matter of harsh methods and, you know, abuse, which, you know, obviously was at the time justified as a way of increasing tension on people to help them have breakthroughs into going beyond ego. You know, how we account for that, we can't, I don't want us to just endlessly talk about it, but we can't ignore it. And then what caused the collapse of the International Enlightened Next community?
Right. First, maybe it is a good starting point that this kind of, let's call it harsh methods, or let's talk about there was also abuse, and let's see if parties, harsh measure parties abuse, I think there are mixed motives of Andrew that we have to talk about. That makes it sometimes also difficult to distinguish. Part, I really would say there was abuse. Part, I really would say Andrew was a harsh teacher, and it was difficult to hold one, to differ one from the other. And it was for me, in fact, this part quite a challenge right from the beginning. When I came to Andrew Cohen some 20 years ago, and in fact, after some time being in the community at that time in Germany, in Cologne, where Andrew really challenged us tremendously for our Germanness, and where he used very rough methods just to put in our face how our German conditioning is a deeply fascist conditioning and how we don't really get it. I felt on one hand that Andrew was right, he was pointing to something, but I also felt that the climate of how we were doing this in our Cologne community was kind of deeply disturbing, lacking also kind of compassion for where we are with all of this. And that was the first time when I wanted to leave the community. That was, I don't know, something like 15, 17 years ago. And this was a very disturbing time already, because it took me several weeks where I just felt this is not going anywhere. This kind of methods where people were just treated in a extremely harsh way to confront ourselves with things that I think is right that we have to be confronted, our kind of ethnical conditioning, but not in that way. And then I told Andrew that I want to leave. And as you said, it was also not so just easy to leave. You basically got challenged if you wanted to leave. So I was asked to come at that point to Fox Hollow, where Andrew was living. And in fact, it took me quite something to fly over there and prepare myself for a meeting that I wanted to confront Andrew why I wanted to leave. Interesting enough, in coming to Fox Hollow, I had a conversation with Elizabeth DeBold, who happens to be now my partner, but at that time we were just friends, and we had a long conversation where Elizabeth really also appreciated the difficulties I had, but at that point we also talked about is there potential in what we're doing? Is there something that is deeply positive in spite of all the challenges? And for the good or for the bad, I felt that this is not right to leave at that point, and that what we were doing has something of very deep spiritual value. And that was a period that led to what I talked last time, where we had a real breakthrough also in the higher week context. So it was a very mixed picture for me several times, because on the one hand, these harsh methods and this abuse kept happening. At the same time, there were things, particular how we came together and how there was so much goodwill to find something deep, people trying to come together beyond ego in a way that I felt was very meaningful. So it was, for me, always a deep, soul-wrenching question. How are we doing this? Is this something that is done in the right way? Is it too harsh? I felt, obviously, ongoing in the end, that there's something that is worthwhile, also standing the things that obviously were wrong with Andrew in all of that. But I have to say, there were a lot of things that, particularly when you look retrospect, were just not right, and where you have to say Andrew at least had harsh, had mixed motives in his harshness.
So you felt that there was something overarchingly really important and worthwhile, but that's kind of an abstract mental category. I think I and probably a lot of listeners would like to hear you just really speak from your heart about what inspires you still about that guru experiment and how that informs what you're passionate about doing now in your work.
That's an interesting question, because what I'm doing right now here in Germany is very much related to exactly this, let's call it higher V work, that people come together in a non-separate way, where people are really themselves as adult human beings with their own responsibility, but also are aware that there is a non-separation that holds us as humanity when we come together. And in fact, this is not only my passion of my work here in Germany, I also do get a lot of feedback that it's from other people who are not related to our community at all, that it seems that we have something to bring here to the field that is important for culture, for consciousness. That there is a kind of sensitivity and understanding of some possibility beyond separation that I relate directly to this ongoing 20 years work with Andrew, with us, where I have deeply the conviction that what I seemingly are able to give right now here, and what is I think is also happening in a way that people are inspired by this, I would not be able to do without this hard work. That doesn't take anything away that not only mistakes were made, that also there were things that were not excusable. So it was a very mixed package. But at the same time, there is something that I still deeply value, and that for me is something very sacred and something real, something very human, and also something very inspiring, because it allows, at least as I see it, to find a way to dive into new possibilities of culture, just in the way how people can, in dialogue, in working together, hold something in consciousness, being aware of consciousness, being aware of spirit, and being aware of something that is beyond the separated I sense, at the same time being fully responsible human beings. And I think that's also something that I had to learn, because I think one of the things where I really had to go in different ways than we did it, to really emphasize our the necessity of our individuality and the necessity of our individual freedom in all of this, in a way that we didn't do in the work with Andrew.
You know, this is, I mean, it seems like the premise of Andrew's work is that ego is incredibly powerful, and that it expresses itself in so many insidious ways that a certain kind of crisis needs to be created in individuals so that they can actually function beyond ego. And that harshness and very tough demands can be a necessary part of the process through which people are drawn to a level of evolutionary intensity where they can break through, and that behaviors that in another context wouldn't be appropriate can be appropriate if they're done in service of this higher value, and that in fact, you know, the argument was given to me many times by many, many people, including some people who are now very critical. But, you know, years ago when I was kind of evaluating this, I was hearing from a lot of folks that that there were a lot of individual breakthroughs into another level of transpersonal freedom and intensity and commitment to their real values that were coming out of this harsh work. And I found myself dealing with a lot of cognitive dissonance right from the beginning because I'd had a kind of a negative reaction to Andrew initially. I think I mentioned that on the first call, and felt kind of turned off that there seemed to be an unsympathetic attitude toward people's humanity that felt fundamentally unhealthy and potentially abusive. But I kept encountering people, yourself included, but many other people I've collaborated with, Craig Hamilton for one, certainly Carter Phipps, Chris Parrish, but many, many others, Mike Wambacher, Willa Gertzema, I mean, I can go on and on, people that impacted me, the quality of their commitment, intelligence. You know, I saw this again and again, that Andrew's students seemed to have a depth of seriousness about practice that wasn't common, even among people in the integral community. There was a seriousness and a willingness to go beyond unconscious patterns that I really had to admire. So I found myself thinking of what I had seen around Adi Da, in which I have huge bodies of experience that are almost completely incompatible. To some degree, it's like state-specific. I have a huge body of my own experience that I can access only in the mode of a grateful devotee who's seeing my root guru and as divine and as just effulgent and beautiful and have no critical thoughts or feelings, and then another whole body of experience that I can access in a similar state-specific way, only with a very autonomous, critical eye, and with the strength to have self-graduated and said no and stood back and become very critical. And yet these two bodies of experience have each been critical to my growth, and I wouldn't want to legislate away the opportunity for groups of people to get together and engage in extreme experiments because I feel like I've benefited so much. In fact, having been displaced from a single narrative that can contain all my experience has been part of what has opened me up to being a much freer, more loving, more flexible, more fully committed participant in this evolutionary process. Mm-hmm. And yet, I can see that there are a lot of people who were hurt by Andrew, really hurt, and who, you know, are seeming casualties of this experiment. And that grieves me, and I'm sure it must grieve you, and you probably stood close to it and maybe cooperated with a certain amount of that happening. And I'm sure that you're having, you know, you may be even still in the process of metabolizing your regret or your self-questioning around the ways in which you may have colluded with that, and at the same time still obviously you feel like taking a fierce stand for the values that motivated you in the first place. And, you know, how is that going? I kind of ask these questions in a general way, but I think you're ready to look at way you answered them the first time and maybe go a cut deeper.
First, I want to say what you highlighted in the beginning of what you just said is the crux of the matter, because I'm deeply convinced that let's say this very fierce experiments that they are more serious than other experiments that I was aware of, they created results. I mean, good results. And what the people you're describing, that's my experience also. That the people there's real results of people really finding depth in something that is unusual. At the same time, and that's the crux of it, that only really works if the motive is pure, clear, or at least not as mixed as it was with Andrew. And it has to be said, with Andrew, it was very mixed. And one thing that I have to question myself is that I saw things that were obviously coming from mixed motives, and I did not respond to it in a way that really reflected my own realization of this mixed package that Andrew had. I mean, it was a difficult situation, but still, me as an adult, a human being who has compassion and has friends, I saw a lot that I should not have tolerated. That's something, on one hand, when you're in the midst of an experiment, you also go beyond borders and that, but that's the danger of it. And when you cross borders, you should not have crossed. That just happened, and you have to deal with this. And I think this is something that will be with me for the rest of my life. In fact, what I'm doing right now, at least attempts also to be a response to that, because the very dimension that you were highlighting, the appreciation that on one hand there is this kind of unfolding of this creative force that we really come together as human beings, but on the other hand there is also the individual with his own or her own humanity, and Andrew didn't appreciate that enough and really destroyed things here. There is a way where both can be held together, and I think at least what I try to do here, what we try to do here, is also to prove that this both things can go together and have to go together. And of course, we will make our own mistakes in all that, but I think the best I can do is to really honor my experience, both sides of my experience, that there's something very deep and something very important, at least to my heart, that has to do with the human potential to come together in a higher way. But there's also something in the appreciation of our humanness and also our limits and also our weak sides that Andrew did not appreciate. It has to be part of this. And if it's not part of this, we go somewhere where it's not only getting dangerous, it's getting wrong. And I think the best I can do to respond also to things that I should have done differently in previous times is to try to find a different way in this. And that's part of what we try to do here. And also to that's another thing. I think this higher coming together is in itself not congruent with the pyramid structure of this particular pyramid structure of hierarchy that we had. That Andrew also created something or catalyzed something here that. Even if his motive would have been right completely, there would have been the need to transcend his particular guru form of doing this, because this coming together needs a different way of really higher form of community and higher form of spiritual community, where it's not just about a pyramid, but there's a natural hierarchy, something very different than creating pyramids. It's basically appreciating our difference and our being together. And Andrew didn't want to go there. So also in this, what we can do, what we have to do is to see, is this possible to do this in a different way than this pyramid structure? And that is beyond or before any abuse. This is the structure itself, I think, that was at least limited.
So in other conversations, you've said to me that you think the real reason that Enlightened Next collapsed had to do really with what you've just brought up.
Yeah.
So explain that a little bit more fully. What was the critical thing here? That there were always some issues around Andrew's mixed motives, about some unexamined shadow, about things that weren't challenged, that were a complication, but that still there was enough of a certain kind of enlightenment, if we can, you know, like a number of people have written in saying, hey, what kind of enlightenment is congruent, you know, how can he be enlightened if he's hurt people in these various ways, if he's done these things that violate their boundaries so harshly? And, you know, there are many definitions of different kinds of enlightenment, and it can be, you know, according to some ways of looking at it, possible to have tremendous freedom in certain ways and still tremendous shadow in other ways. And if we accept that as an explanation here, maybe Wilbur's levels and lines, and say, okay, maybe there's an enlightenment that Andrew did possess, even though in other respects he was full of shadow, he may have helped take people to a domain of evolutionary freedom and cooperation and a higher intersubjectivity in a way that was profoundly innovative, even though he did that in ways that lacked care for the humanity of a variety of people and let some of them have, you know, apparently, you know, victim experiences. Now, if that was so and there was something that could sustain itself, then there was a critical blow, a straw that broke the camel's back, or maybe something more than a straw. And in past conversations, you said to me that you think it was because the work had borne fruit enough that there was a higher we that he refused to submit to. Please tell us what that was really like.
That's exactly the case. But I think we have to make a distinction here because there are two things at the same time. Maybe both are related to mixed motives, but in a different way. Because on one hand, we're talking about, let's call it the abuse and things that should not have happened anyway. The other is slightly different than that. It's a particular structure, how to pursue the spiritual life, which is the guru model, and the particular form of guru model are being what I would call this pyramid structure. And this pyramid structure, let's put it that way, Andrew was pushing, and I think that's the best part of him, he was pushing for something where he consciously said, how you guys, how we come together is more important than our relationship to him. That there's something, an enlightened spirit between humans, how they live together as a living, creative force of community that is more important than the teacher relationship. So he was consciously pushing for that. But at the same time, I think he was successful in that. I mean, we can talk about it if this is a right assumption, but I really think he was successful in that. But at the same time, as you said, he did not submit to this, because at least at that point where this became kind of stable, because there was also a time where this different, let's call it higher we space, just for calling it somehow, opened up. It was not stable at all, but it was there, and it needed kind of guidance to hold this. But there was a point where it became more stable, and where something that Andrew was asking for, at least he said he was asking for, namely a new form of partnership of spiritual people, would have been possible. But that would have needed that Andrew would have stepped into this higher space. He never did. I think he supported it, he helped to catalyze it, but he never stepped into it, he never submitted to this. And this is, as I said, different than the abuse story. That's like a structural thing. But I think in the end, it is also a question of motive, because if you really want this, you also have to give up your particular position staying outside of this. So why are you not doing this? And I think what he created in this is an inherent contradiction of something that in itself I think was something very, very important, and the structure that does not keep up with what we achieved. And Andrew refused ongoingly. That's, I mean, the other part of the story, but that's a crucial part. He refused to surrender to what he created, and that was is part of the crisis. It's not all of it. It's by far not all of it. Economic part of it, there's the abuse part of it, but it's the central part of it that he did not submit to what he co-created with us.
Now, you had been, as you've told me in the past, this incident that you recounted of being ready to leave and then being persuaded through your conversation with Elizabeth not to leave, that was only one of several times that you felt things had gone too far in one way or another and you were ready to leave the community. So you were aware of all this. You were involved in a structure of verticality where you were, at various times, mostly a more senior student, more trusted, and in a position where you knew things that others didn't know, and you were, there were a lot of others who were subject to the larger patterns of Enlightened Next, and you were in a position of responsibility. And so this was always obviously a moral dilemma, because you knew things they didn't know, they were subject to things, they were contributing money, they were investing their life energy. Uh-huh. You had your own doubts. This felt like a moral challenge to you, obviously. So what can you unpack that for us more?
I mean, the moral challenge was ongoingly, and it was always a question of, in the end, it came down to that there were things that I just could not agree with, and something that I think is very important what we are doing here together, and how to hold one against the other, and how to see Andrew with this. In the end, do I trust his motive or do I trust my perception? And that's a whole dilemma, because having a relationship to a spiritual teacher is a relationship of trust. So you consciously make a choice to trust. But at the same time, you cannot do this these days anymore in a non-responsible way, in a way where you not take responsibility that you are an adult human being of the 20th or 21st century, that even if you trust, you're responsible for your trust and the choices. That's a kind of a built-in contradiction, and I don't really know how to deal with it then. You have to live this contradiction. And I mean, one incident, which is another incident where I basically decided to leave and then in the end, again, did not do it, was around 2001. And it was, in fact, not just about Enlightened Next in that sense, but it was very much connected to Andrew. Because I was living at that time after the 30th of July, after the attack of the Twin Towers in America, and there was this unbelievable build-up to the Iraq War, and there was a kind of a groupthink building up where I felt, also coming from Germany, unbelievable suffocated, how any kind of doubt was basically something that made you an ally of Saddam Hussein or something like this. And this was not just an Enlightened Next thing, because it was, in that case, something that really irritated me about the whole American culture at this point, but it was very highlighted how there was a kind of a monophyletic way how we were allowed to think. I remember that basically, Andrew, more or less, I have to say more or less, forced us to come down when the American troops conquered Baghdad to celebrate Bush. And I went there because I felt I could not do that. But I went there, everyone knew that I hated the Iraq War. And I felt this is a completely brainwashing culture. And again, I said, I don't want to be part of this. And then we can talk why I, in the end, again, thought, no, in spite of all of this, we are doing something important here, and did not leave. In fact, Andrew had paid me quite a high price for this, not a financial price, but a different price, when I decided not to leave. But these were moments of deep reckoning, and you're in a situation where there's something that you deeply value, and I still do, and there's things where you think, I can't be part of this. And then you have to make a choice.
So maybe I should wade in to saying some things about this from my perspective. The reason I'm doing these dialogues with you, it's interesting, I got one very lovely email from my old friend Samuel Bonder, who was basically saying, kudos to you. You can only irritate people by doing this. There's no personal benefit that accrues, and you're obviously doing this because you want to serve something. I appreciate you for doing it. I was grateful to hear that said, because I'm mostly feeling the other side of it. But the reason I'm doing this is because I saw something spectacular go on among a bunch of you there working in Enlighten Next. There was a coherent field in which you were being drawn together to a self-transcending disposition. At least some of you were able to have that experience. Perhaps others just got hurt, but at least many people that I met were drawn into something where you were taking the consideration at the leading edge of the evolution of Dharma and the evolution of practice into higher intersubjectivity and into an evolutionary view of what spirituality really is, that was stunning. And many of the issues of What is Enlightenment and Enlighten Next magazine were tremendously valuable. And Andrew's own dharmic innovations and the kind of radical commitment that everybody seemed to be sharing were, I thought, a very valuable contribution to progressive spirituality in general. And much happened that I was really excited by. And in fact, when I waded into my personal relationship with Andrew in the first place, it was to say to him, you're doing such important work that I feel a commitment to tell you that aspects of your personality and style are undermining the credibility of something I value, and I want you to notice that these things ought to be shifted. And it was out of my passionate commitment to the work itself that Andrew began to respect and engage me in a way that I appreciated, and I developed a friendship with him. Since this has happened, I've had a few opportunities to talk with him by Skype, as recently as 2.5 months ago, and what I could see is that he really has been humbled by this. He is aware that he demanded things of his students that he's never gone through himself, and he's reckoning with it in a way that is, I don't think he's gone through everything I would like to see him go through. I don't want to vouch for who he is and how he is yet. I think he's in a process. One of the key things that's come out of our conversations is I've always disagreed mightily with one of his principles, this idea of top-down versus bottom-up, the idea that transformational choices can always be made immediately on the basis of understanding a higher principle, no matter how much resistance, and that just increasing the pressure on someone is sufficient and that people should be able to move right now. I think I am inclined to grant him a little time to metabolize the enormity of the shifts he's got to go through. But he never offered that kind of time to anyone else, and the irony of that is, you know, obvious. Nonetheless, I would give that compassion to anyone, including the people who are healing their wounds. That's one key principle that seems important here. There's another one that was brought to my attention by Wesley Rosiker, and it has to do with the binary worldview underpinning the teachings, heaven and hell. Heaven is self-transcendence and enlightenment and living by the evolutionary impulse and the absolute reality. Hell is living by ego and postmodern, narcissism. And that binary view underpinned this. And Wesley asked me to ask you, as a teacher and the head of Enlightened Ex Germany, do you still see that binary worldview of ego versus authentic self as the foundation of how you work? And in reflection, do you think this is what was the key problem, this permeating the community and the teachings? And isn't it a false dichotomy? And now, why don't you speak to the positives or pedagogical advantages if you think there are some?
I think you and Wesley are completely right. This is one of, let's say, the philosophical problems with what we did, which connected to kind of problems of motivation, created big parts of what did not go right. And at the same time, it was also the foundation of going somewhere where you go beyond your comfort zone you wouldn't do otherwise. Because I think the question about, let's call it binary, if there's good and there's evil, if there's good and there's bad, the troubles are on both sides. Because if you kind of have this in this black and white way that Andrew taught, it's very easy to get into any kind of fundamentalist thinking. If you, on the other hand, say you cannot talk about this, you cannot say that there is some ideal of something really good in humanity, something really life-affirming, you don't have something to aspire to, you really end up with relativism. I think you have to hold the complexity of this, that there are ideals that have to be held, and they have to be deeply held in a way that they mean something to you, how you want to live your life, that there's really something good, really something life-affirming that is important. And it really makes a difference if you really pursue that or not, and at the same time realize that the concreteness of life is very concrete and doesn't hold up to black and white pictures at the same time. That's theoretically, you can answer this quite easily, maybe, but practically, this is you have to hold a lot of complexity, because you have to hold that something really good, something really positive, something ideal, some utopia is really something to aspire for, not just to kind of think about and have nice thought about it, but something that really drives your life. That's the power of this. But if you then mix this up with the complexity of life and think that that life itself only exists in these binary realities, then you end up in some kind of fundamentalist thinking. And in that sense, it was the foundation of a lot of the troubles. At the same time, I think it is important to hold up the ideal and say, yes, I am. And that's still, I'm standing for an utopia. I'm standing for a real deep human possibility for something really life-affirming, really good. At the same time, I know the concreteness of life is complex.
I've reflected on this quite a lot, having been challenged by the excellence that I saw among some of you some years ago, and the degree to which this binary high pressure had drawn you to transcend yourselves in a way that might have been in some respects hyper-masculine, but was still clearly transformative. And I found myself almost envying you for the purity and intensity of the field in which you were practicing. I saw that there was something going on that was beautiful, even though there were aspects of it that I frankly could have, never submitted myself to. So I appreciate what you're saying. It seems to me that there might be a higher synthesis. Rather than looking at this as the difference between an either-or binary system versus a more non-dual system that is both and includes both and doesn't take an extreme position, it may be that we should notice that there are important truths and values that are held by both forms of pedagogy, and that there's a both and that includes the either or intensity of the true and the false, and the pressure that that can build up, and the importance of a bigger view that can relativize perspectives and not simply be endlessly bound up in it, in what you, I think, rightly call a fundamentalism or an absolutism.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I mean, in my own story, I was confronted to deal with this also when I came back to Germany, in a way, because I have to add to what you said before, my position of responsibility in the context of Enlightenment Next started with coming back to Germany. And one of my attempts was also to really try different things here. And what I ended up here was also that I really wanted to work together with let's call it other people. So you know them. They're friends like Sonja Student from the Integral Movement here, Jens Heisterkamp from the Anthroposophist, where I was drawn to create something that was beyond our particular, let's say, ideology. And that put me in a very odd position, because on one hand, I was standing for something particular, which was Enlightened Next. On the other hand, I felt, and there was a strong contradiction within that, that what we are doing as Enlightened Next only has value if we do it for something that is beyond ourselves. It's not for Enlightened Next, but something that is some progressive, evolutionist, spirituality, or however you want to call it, and you have to hold these contradictions. And in fact, I was, from Andrew and from others, quite under strong pressure not to do that, and even be accused of being very German in doing this. But in the end, I think that this is part of what saved my soul here.
Well, I've been very impressed with what you've done there. I've been impressed with Sonja, I've been impressed with Jens and you, and also Annette Kaiser and Lisa Schutmacher, others that you've cooperated with in various ways. Because there is a collaboration that isn't based on a shared dharma or a completely shared path. And that's exactly what we need to begin to be able to do. And I think you've actually done things I haven't seen done even in America as fully as I'm seeing you guys do it. So I that's one of the reasons I've come to respect you and feel that you are involved in dharmic innovation now in your dialogue work and in your collaboration work that stands on its own two feet, you know, independent of what you, you know, your time as a student of Andrew. And one of the things you said to me about that was the only reason that our work has survived is that when we came to the test and the cult was collapsing, we behaved in a way that wasn't like a cult. We did something different. That obviously came from someplace in yourself that was pretty deep. And, you know, you tend to express yourself philosophically and to some degree abstractly, but clearly there was a heart of care at the core of this, as well as some fiercely held distinctions that you were very committed to. And I want to give you a chance to speak those as powerfully as you're able.
I'm not exactly clear what you're asking. The motive to do this was my understanding of the evolutionary impulse, and that the evolutionary impulse only can live in a live engagement between human beings. So something that is already a fixed dogma of anything cannot be alive. And being together here in Germany and also being very concerned to create something real here in this culture, the only way to do this is you find friends, you want to do something together, and there will be never people who you are completely agreeing with. So if you want to create something for real, if you really want to create cultural change, you have to hold contradictions just for the sake of doing something together. And I learned a lot just practically with people like Sonia and Jens, because we held and we still have to hold a lot of contradictions, and there's something holding us together because of our deep commitment to spirit, our deep commitment to evolution, also our deep commitment to change culture in this country, and to be kind of a field where something like a progressive spirituality can have a dialogue. This is something that is my understanding of what the evolutionary impulse is about. And in fact, what we tried to create here, in fact, what we were in the process of creating here, this whole take on evolutionary dialogue, is my understanding that everything we are doing, also in the integral world, only exists in dialogue. Because the beautiful thing of a dialogue versus a theory is, a theory is something that I have, I can develop it, but I have it. But a dialogue, and I'm talking with you right now, I hear you and you hear me, and there's something alive between us, also the different perspectives. And this dialogue that you and I are having right now is only alive if I really listen to you, in particular listen to that part you are saying that I don't agree yet already to. Only if I do this and if you do that, and there is some kind of higher synthesis in this conversation that we're having, these conversations alive. That's my understanding of the evolutionary impulse. So if I want to live some kind of evolutionary spirituality with you right now in this conversation, I have to listen, and I have to listen to that part that I don't like to hear and that I'm not familiar with. Only if I do this really, and we are staying together in some joint interest to find something else, this dialogue will be a live one. That's true for the conversation of the two of us right now, but that's true in general, and that's my understanding of evolutionary spirituality.
So this, I mean, that is exciting to me, because what I'm seeing is that we are in a time in which Dharma has to evolve so quickly that fixed positions are the problem in general. And clearly, if something had begun to emerge through Andrew's, you know, sometimes questionable work, but work that had some, you know, that produced something that also had value, if he was unable in the critical moment to submit to that transformational shift, that might be the real cause for the demise of Enlightened Next, maybe the opportunity. And this is where I'm really, you know, I saw such psycho-spiritual capital built and coherence built among people who were working together under his leadership and sovereignty. And although there was always something a little cultic and funny about the whole thing, there was also something powerful. And I've felt a lot of mixed feelings, in that it was clear that there was something that had to be purified and cleansed, and a kind of reckoning had to happen. And that's happening now more and more. And I hope that it'll happen for Andrew personally in a way that'll be redemptive. But I don't want to see the psycho-spiritual capital and coherence that was built up simply dissipated. You know, it needs to be used by evolution. And this listening to one another and really being in dialogue and challenging one another, which was an art and practice that you guys developed, at least to a limited degree within certain boundaries at Enlightened Next. If that can break out of those boundaries, and the people who were participating in it before can actually stay connected to a self-transcending impulse, so that they're not, you know, there's been too much bickering, to my mind, on the online thing. People just with a fixed, it's all bullshit, Andrew was terrible, you know, people just need to reckon. You know, I think that there is a natural process when one has been involved in a way of thinking that has straitjacketed your freedom, where you kind of have to just differentiate yourself from it and simply be a critic. For me, when I first left the ashram of Adi Da, I felt nothing but dissident feelings for 2 or 3 years. I couldn't get close to any of his writings. I felt in certain moments as if I'd wasted my, you know, young adult life. I went through terrible times. But after I did that, I was able to come back and appreciate everything that had been built and become really grateful for the incomparable gifts that I'd been given and grateful to be who I had become in the process and then to be related to both sides of my experience. I'm really hoping that many of the people who have been involved with Andrew have a commitment to the principles that attracted them to it in the first place that is greater than their trauma and greater than their commitment to their ideas about it, such that something like what you're talking about can emerge and there can be a truly productive dialogue that continues to press this evolutionary spirituality forward, because it is continuing to evolve and needs to evolve, and the kind of tight boundaries that existed around Enlightened Next served certain purposes that, if those lessons can be conferred productively, not just negatively, not just as a cautionary tale, but as an example of some positive injunctions, we're all going to be enriched.
No, I very much agree, Terry. And I mean, the hopes I have, well, let's put it the other way. The last conversation, I talked about the baby and the bathwater, and I got also some comments that basically, what are you talking about? What is the baby? That's what we are talking about right now. That's what I would call the baby. And it's we can talk more and define, but this kind of aliveness of human spirit in recognizing the depth of spirit, our non-separateness, our kind of engaged, evolving in something, and the depth of humanity in this, going somewhere, that is something that I deeply believe that I was taught in being in this context with Andrew Cohen. And then a lot of things were done wrong, were abusive, were done maybe in ways that could have been done in a different way. It's a lot of things that went down, but at the same time, there are people who I know were deeply touched by this. And I hope that we find ways to kind of honor this part of our shared experience and find different ways to hold this. Because I don't think there's one way how to go with this experience of what we did in Enlightened Next. I think that also this will be dialogical. There will be different ways. If there's a shared recognition of something where we honor both sides, where we honor the really drastic mistakes and abusive mistakes, and honor that something very powerful was part of this too, and then let's talk how this can be in all the different ways, how people try to learn from this, a contribution to the development of culture. That if we find ways to do this where we don't turn cynical on spirit, don't turn cynical on the evolution of humanity, but use the experiences we have to really find new ways to create human culture, I think something also quite powerful can come out of that. And I think this conversation, it's part of why I asked you for this conversation, should be a part where we all these different perspectives also find a way to really see both sides and see how can we create something that is not cynical, that allows the recognition also the depth of human spirit and the depth of the creativity of human spirit to be part of the conversation.
Mm. Yes, well, I think that's where we meet and why we're friends. I'm with you 100%. I'm realizing that we've gone long enough, and I know you had wanted to read a couple of questions that you got, including one from my friend Jeff Belzy. I want to give you a chance to go into that.
Yeah, maybe that's the time. In fact, I on a Facebook group, I asked some people also if they had questions. Jeff Belzy was one who came with a question I would like to read here. Where Jeff writes, Tom, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on what bad habits we learned and what damage was done in the name of errors, without being philosophical about it and without pointing too many fingers at Andrew, of course. There's real trail of blood and the habits were cultivated together, which created so much suffering, do not go away just by Andrew is no longer the guru. I think the bad habits, I mean, part of the bad habits we did talk about, it is the non-appreciation of us being humans in that. Because there's one thing, let's say, in the conversation that we are having right now, Terry, that the appreciation of spirit and something really creative unfolding between us, but there's something different appreciating you as Terry with who you are, with your strengths, with your biography, and we did not appreciate this human side in the way that is necessary. And to be honest, again, my cooperation with friends here in Germany just taught me a lot, and I also was not too willing to accept the lessons right away, but I'm grateful for, in fact, a lot of dialogues where I was challenged on that and look into my own my own blind spot in this, and I'm in the process of this. Also, as you're saying, and you're not the first one, I'm a very philosophical person. I mean, I studied philosophy, and I love philosophical ideas. That's my strength of it. But it's also my weakness, because a philosophical point of view allows you a big perspective, but it also allows you to underappreciate the humanness of a particular situation. Just here I am, and here you are, and same with other people. And without the context, it's also just the humanness that has to be part of the picture. And that's something that is definitely one of the bad habits that I think I also brought it into in Leibniz. It was not just something that I learned there, but something that got cultivated there and strengthened a side that was my weak side in the beginning. And I have to look this.
Yeah. Well, I think that there's probably an opening into a lot of growth during this next period of time. I know that the years after I left my formal involvement with the ashram were enormously tumultuous for me. And it's sometimes said that it takes, it takes 1 year for every 3 years you were in a cult, so to speak, for you to completely, you know, pull yourself out of it. I doubt if that's going to have to take that long for you, but there's a trajectory to this process of reintegrating, and the fact that there are aspects of this that are not merely intellectual, but are probably, biopsycho-spiritual, and that, may have a trajectory that goes some years ahead. I'm glad you're acknowledging that, and I think your willingness to say so now, bodes well for your future trajectory with it. One of the things that I appreciate is that you are able to hold that humility and at the same time stand in a leadership position in relationship to other people, and have had to be pretty strong during a time when there were a lot of centrifugal forces that would have dissipated everything you were doing in Germany. And I think it's better that there is something cohesive, and that is dedicated to dialogue, and that you're in a place of humble growth in your way of participating in leadership, and that you're sharing leadership. All of that gives me a sense of possibility.
I just think that it's something which will be always the case, and also at least in my case, it is not something that that I only picked up in the enlightened next culture. It's something that I brought into. And in the culture we created, like in any kind of closed culture, which you can call cultish culture, it doesn't have to be a religious, spiritual cultish culture. There are all kinds of cultish cultures that are closed mindsets. You create certain habits if you want to go beyond these closed groups, you have to break your own habits. And this is not an easy process, because it's not just the intellectual insight. It's a deep human process, and I see it takes time, and it's an ongoing thing. I I don't think that this is a thing that ever will end in that way, because if we take evolution really serious, and if I also take serious that my motives are mixed motives, I have to look and learn in this, and I hope I will continue to look and learn in this.
Well, in line with that, let me ask you a very challenging question that came to me this morning via email from Matthias Olsen. He begins by saying, "Thanks, Tom, for sticking your neck out, and thanks, Terry, for initiating the talks." A year and a half ago, EnlightenX suddenly collapsed in a way that took everybody by surprise. You spoke last time about Andrew having made mistakes. In my view, a mistake could have been corrected, but last year's events exposed a much deeper pathology within the organization and the leadership. It was undoubtedly Andrew's lack of integrity that triggered the collapse, but my hypothesis is that the same lack of integrity permeated the structure itself, and those of us involved were all participating to different degrees. One of the most defining moments I can think of having experienced during my time as a student of Andrew's was a meeting in January 2012 with about 40 other students from the inner circles. And at that meeting, one of the former editors of EnlightenX magazine voiced his doubts and concerns about where the organization was going. And hearing such doubts was a shock for everyone. Personally, my instant reaction was to see him as a traitor. He was publicly slaughtered, metaphorically speaking, and left soon after. Nobody stood up for him or to hear him out. It's my understanding that you yourself and the small group of most senior students were already quite aware of Andrew's lack of integrity and issues with power at the time of that meeting, and yet none of you said anything. I also understand that among the former senior students, you were the greatest proponent of keeping the lid on, not letting anybody else know about Andrew's issues. In hindsight, how do you look at your own leadership as a former senior student at this most crucial time, and what does that say about the integrity of the organization?
First, it has to be said, the culture in EnlightenX is not just Andrew's culture, it's our culture. And of course, being it a pyramid culture, Andrew has the biggest part in this, but to the degree people had responsibility, and me here definitely included, there is collective responsibility for the culture that we are creating. In that sense, Matthias is completely right, and I and others, we individually, and it differs as everything in different cases, there are very different things to re-look into that. And people, I think, partly are doing this, partly not. But it is in itself a process where we have to see what were our downsides, also what we try to hold together. Because in this particular transition, I don't think that I was trying to hold the lid on. I was trying to force Andrew. A group of us confronted Andrew that things had to change, and I wanted to give Andrew time to respond. And I think still this there was a right thing to do, to give Andrew time to respond. Unfortunately, he did not respond. But I don't think it was wrong to give Andrew that time and put also pressure on him to do that. At some point, the time ran out, but I think the attempt to really allow Andrew to respond was not necessarily the wrong thing. So in this particular case, I still think that was the right thing to do. And of course, around that, we also made a lot of mistakes, but this particular thing, to give Andrew the time to respond, I think, it's also a human thing, and it also, I think, if well, let's say it the other way, I think also the crisis of international EnlightenX has partly to big degree to do with Andrew, but also a big degree to do that in the moment of challenge, there was, from my perspective, not enough will to kind of do this together, to go through this together in a way that is honoring what we try to do and looking into things that need to be looked into. If there would have been more strength to do this together, I think we could have gone through this crisis in a different way.
So what you're saying is that you felt that there was enough truth, that Andrew was pointing in a direction that had enough truth in it, that even with all his foibles and excesses and mixed motives, that the fundamental experiment had a core that was awake and transcendent and really valuable, and that if the leadership could have somehow stayed really cohesive and stayed in that higher we and made a demand on Andrew that he submit to that, that somehow it could have self-purified and that it didn't have to fall apart.
But the point is, Terry, we will never find out. I really think so, yeah. I think that what happened
was you thought so at the time, and you still tend to see it that way.
Yeah, I still tend to see it. I think what happened was a double crisis. It was the Andrew crisis, and it was a crisis of a collective leadership, where, from my perspective, and I know different people see it differently, holding together and creating transparency and holding at the same time the truth of what we were doing would have allowed to do this learning process in a different way.
You know, it's been an interesting thing for me because I hear truth in almost every perspective that's raised in this context. I have been excoriated by some of Andrew's most fervent critics because I went ahead and defended aspects of his work several years ago in a couple things that I wrote. And they just saw me as enabling abuse, and they see it in pretty black and white terms. And they're not wrong. Clearly there were people who might have been influenced by my writings to stay involved, who might have been exposed to demands or very intense inner conflicts that were at least complicating and maybe even hurtful. Maybe they were, I don't think there were those, my understanding is that the extreme behaviors that are talked about in the books and blogs had shifted then, but there were still qualities of psychological coercion in the field, and I'm sure some people must have been exposed to at least some of that. And I take that very much to heart. I don't think that that's a trivial thing. On the other hand, I felt right from the beginning that just like some of the people who are Adi Da's worst critics, there was a real loss of passion for the thing itself. The reason that I came to my teacher, the reason you came to your teacher, was that there was a transcendent possibility, a better world that our hearts know is possible, in the phrase of Charles Eisenstein. We know that something better is possible, and that our world's in a moment when profound transition is necessary and may be possible, and that the most caring and compassionate and committed and conscious of us can perhaps play a role. And an effort dedicated to breaking through boundaries in that domain and taking risks and letting it get messy seems to me somehow still very interesting. And when it bears real fruit, at least valuable. And so I care about this psycho-spiritual capital that became coherent around Andrew. It seems to me that there's still something precious there that I hate to see completely dissipate, and for people to simply become conventional participants in the consensus trance of the day-to-day world, which is not heading to a good place. So that's what I care about in the midst of this. And yet, it seems that there's no way to wade into this and come out of it with clean hands. You don't have clean hands. I don't think I have clean hands, even regards Andrew, let alone Adi Da. And yet, Adi Da still stands forth to me as a presence of what is possible in a human body, mind, transcendent, radiant, beautiful, amazing, awake, transmissive, in a way that informs my life. His capacity for feeling and love, really, just the field itself, the field effect of being around him, continues to uplift who I am. And I'm sure that there are aspects of what you broke through together, particularly in your enlightened intersubjectivity, that continue to inform you. And somehow we have to be a stand for that and an open heart of care for the humanity of everyone. And there was clearly a failure of compassion that can't be understated, and that somehow this has to be underlined and taken forward, you know, with a broken heart, in a way that Andrew hasn't been able to fully do yet.
No, Terry, I very much agree with what you said. There's something I want to add, and it's at least one of the lessons I think I have to learn from this, is this kind of passionate going somewhere to a higher possibility needs to be done, but it only can be done in freedom, meaning in free choice. You can't put this on people. And Andrew, I mean, in one hand, he always said he only wants this in free choice, but on the other hand, there was not enough room and also not enough consideration what people can take. You really need to really see the other person, see how far someone wants to go, and let him or her decide how far someone wants to go in this. So this part of freedom, I think, is an unbelievably important part. I know in itself that's a contradiction, because how can you push someone and respect his or her freedom at the same time? It's hard to do this without getting your hands dirty. But I'm completely convinced the way we did it, Andrew did it, was way on the wrong side in this. There has to be way more respect for individual choices and also in individual capacities to do this. And we have to find ways how we can include it. That's at least one of the lessons I try to learn, and I try also to follow in what we are doing here. And I hope we learn from this.
Yeah. Good. Well, you know, I see some comments coming in from people who want to ask you to. I think there are people who are wanting to hear emotion, I guess, you know, remorse, not an intellectual acknowledgement of mistakes, which makes it more abstract, but more of a felt connection to the ways that you supported something that was hurting people, and maybe a more embodied connection to the lesson of it. And you've acknowledged that in the way that you've been able to so far. But if I'm going to do justice to some of the comments I see coming in, and I think justice to you, I want to press you a little further. I know it's not so easy for you to talk in that way, but you know, if there is a real trail of blood and you have some of it on your hands, you know, I think some of the healing involves, you know, metaphorically, at least, some tears.
I mean, to be honest, this is very difficult for me because I find myself basically between two harsh things, because this has to be acknowledged. At the same time, I find myself also in a position where I really feel deeply I have to hold up, as not so many people are doing this time, that there was also the context of something very important. And it may be also my weakness, my weak part, to do this together, I find very challenging, because there are a lot of things that I feel very deeply about. And at the same time, I don't want to go down in the way that this is something that kind of is the only thing that is real here. And I really particular on a public call like this, I I find it quite challenging, because I do feel tremendously for things I know that happened. And I feel at the same time this is not the only reality, and how to hold this together, I find humanly very challenging to deal with.
Well, I totally respect that. And I have compassion for you and compassion for those who want me to press you further. I think both voices are part of a larger dialogue that is important. The fact that you're acknowledging it and willing to submit yourself to it and know that you have things to learn in the process is enough for me to continue to feel a lot of respect and compassion for you. And I want to see you go through whatever it takes for you to show up in ways that will satisfy even those who want more. There are a lot of other questions that have been asked. Many of them are very rich. I am a little overwhelmed with what's come in that I have been able to read, and there's a certain amount that's come in during the call that I haven't. But there's one that came out that I think might be fruitful, and it's actually to both of us. But Tim Mansfield from London is asking, in last week's dialogue, Terry in passing praised Andrew's work on evolutionary spirituality. How do Terry and Tom interpret the dissolution of Enlightened Next if looking through an evolutionary lens? That is, if we are all pawns in a mess in a greater game, what is happening in that greater game? So, why don't you take a pass at that? I have a few things to say too, or if you'd like, I can go first.
If I may say something to that, I'm deeply convinced the greater game is a deep and higher coming together as human beings. And what we did in Enlightened Next was an experiment in that. It was an experiment with mistakes. It was an experiment with mixed motives. It was an experiment with effects on human beings that are really to be regretted. At the same time, it was something that there are many people, really many people, and I'm not just talking about Andrew or some people, many people put a lot of heart, a lot of soul, life, for a higher possibility of coming together, and for the good and for the bad. And I think that what part of what we did and part of what really the outcome is that something shows as a human possibility. And we are not the only one. I think this is something that is showing up in our time. The higher we or new we or we space is something that is not by chance something that is circulating in different circles and the different experiments. I just think what Enlightened Next is and what Enlightened Next was is one of these experiments that try to find a higher integration between unity and individuality. And the best we can do is to really learn our lessons and see what are the downsides, but also what is this higher possibility. Because I think, and then we make the picture much bigger when we talk about our times, when we talk about postmodernity, when we talk about individuation, that there is a turning point in the evolution of human mankind where the individuation process needs, as powerful and important the individuation process is, in the last 30,000 years, need also to be reintegrated in a deep understanding of non-separateness, which in the end is a deep spiritual recognition that I, as an individual, I'm also not separate. There's one process going on, our conversation that we're having right now. The whole thing that we're talking about in Enlightened Next is part of a thing that is our human evolution, our spiritual evolution. And to have a deep, not intellectual, but a deep soul understanding of the non-separateness of that is something that is, I think, in the air. And there are beautiful other groups that experiment with the same thing. And I think what we did here is one important experiment that allows us to make steps further in where we have to go as a culture. That, I think, is the bigger story here.
I resonate with everything you've just said. I want to add a few things. I think that the greater game is also that we've got society in a kind of moment of crisis and a huge transition in culture. And one of the biggest stories that I think people will be telling about this time in, you know, several hundred years will be the marriage of science and spirit, which is coming out of rationality and transrationality, the emergence of transrational spirituality as a source of inspiration and a source of possibility. But there are a lot of versions of what that spirituality might be, and some of them are just reducing spirituality to neuroscience and kind of Yoser's manual for the brain and having more mindfulness and clarity. Other versions of spirituality have to do with being loving in a personal way, but don't tend to have much of a sense of social responsibility or cultural transformational responsibility. Some of them, many of them, most of them, tend to make it a personal matter, as you pointed out. And this matter of collective awakening is relatively new and not very prominent yet in the broader culture. On so many of those issues, I feel like the Enlightened Next experiment was a progressive influence on that evolution. And my alarm over it is that I think it's given a black eye to some of the principles that my intuitions say are most important. And therefore, it seems to me that there's an obligation that rests with every single one of us who are hearing these words to be a participant who finds a way to move forward as a responsible participant in this evolution of consciousness and culture such that something of this experiment doesn't retard the big process through us taking from it the wrong lessons and yet, in fact, enhances it by our taking the right lessons and us being chastened in a deep way. Thank you, Tim. I think that was a very pertinent and powerful question. There's another question that just came in that's kind of interesting from Rachel Aaron in Woodacre. Her passion for healing collective shadow leads to a question for you. Can you speak more fully about your German background and the ways that this has played out in and through you? And she says that with all blessings, she says.
Yes, I can. And I think my German background plays into many things that we talked about, because I think one strength of the German culture is philosophical depth. One weakness of the German culture is the underappreciation of the human factor, to put it that way. So in that sense, my German background, so to say, helped me also to go with the weaknesses of our Enlightened Next culture. Every culture has certain strengths and certain weaknesses. Like there's nothing like the pioneer spirit of the Americans. There's nothing like the relationship to transcendence of the Indians. There's nothing like the relationship to the subtle energies like the Chinese culture. I think in my background, of course, and I also studied philosophy. There is a strength of holding big contexts in the philosophical way, but there is also something that I have to work with, which is the very thing that we were talking about, to really let the concreteness of human reality in a very direct way that is not just holding big contexts. And in that way, my German background plays in. On the other hand, the German background means also German history. So I am very aware, and it's a big part of what I try to do here, to really reconcile also with the German fascist history and to be aware that what comes out of this German culture, besides that there are many beautiful things that come out of this German culture, there are some of the biggest human catastrophes in human history, which really changed the course of the 20th century. The 20th century would have taken a different course if the First World War, the Second World War, the Holocaust, and the Gulag would not have happened. So much of our disbelief in the human spirit, our disbelief in human possibilities, came out of the catastrophe where the biggest source of what happened there, the reason, came out of my German culture in this. So to really deal with this is something that plays a certain role in German culture nowadays. What I find, what I'm in fact inspired by, is that there's a deep moral reckoning in the German culture just because of that. That if, in fact, it is, I find it very astounding because of this really dark reality in our history, there's something where I feel there's a deep reckoning in the German culture with its own shadow side that creates a moral maturity, not in the whole of society, but in quite some remarkable parts of society, that creates depth and ethical, moral depth that is unusual and that has to give something also into the world process. So I feel there's something in the German culture where our failings and our reckoning with it play into how I live my life, and that plays in everything that we said before, and that's a big part of my motivation.
Well, thank you, Tom. We've gone a little over our hour and a half. I want to make a couple of announcements and give you a chance to say a little something more. If you feel a particular response to anything that you've heard here and you'd like to stay in touch with Tom's work, you can, if you can read German or even if you can just use Google Translate or Chrome, you can visit evolve-magazine.de, evolve-magazine.de, and enlightennext.de. There's also another, herbstacademy-frankfurt.de, and you can get connected. The thing he's mainly doing right now and looking forward to and would like people to be aware of is a global meditation marathon, December 13th and 14th. A 24-hour meditation. You can find out more about that at meditationmarathon.de. That site is in English. If you feel interested in me and the way I've participated here, please get on my mailing list at terrypatten.com. Just my name, TerryPatten.com. And if you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it. They can register for the series at beyondawakeningseries.com. And I will have another interview in just a few days. This coming Sunday, I'll be broadcasting an amazing conversation that I pre-recorded. It's already taken place, and I'm very proud of this wild level of ecstatic, mystical discourse I've been getting into with Andrew Harvey, and we'll be broadcasting the first of a series of those conversations on Sunday, October 19th. Tom, I want to give you a chance to make some sort of a final statement. Obviously, you can't touch on everything that we've gotten into in this whole 90 minutes, but is there anything you'd like to leave people with?
No, I just think that this conversation has to continue, and I think if what we did together in Enlightened Next is of any value, it has to be a collective learning process of exactly the things that we talked about, that there is something, at least I'm convinced, that we really discovered something that is important for culture, and there were a lot of things where things happened that should not have happened, and people were hurt. And just to have a conversation ongoingly, how this can be part of all of us together, creating new steps for humanity, for new forms of the spirituality, it really helps us together. If we have this conversation, then I think it can be useful to really just deal with what the experience of Enlightenment Next was.
Yes, but especially in service to what it is that is our next opportunity and responsibility. And I feel you keeping your eye on that, and this is a place I intend to be collaborating with you on that in the time ahead.
I agree. That's, in the end, all that counts. Because if we're able to really use our experience to do something with it that is of value, then it was not useless.
Yeah. I want to read one comment from many, many comments have come in. I haven't been able to read them all, but Marjorie Shalita in City Greenville said, what we're asking of ourselves and of Tom can only be partially stated today because the process isn't completed yet. The healing's not complete, and therefore the heart of the issue cannot be fully realized, that I would say metabolized and embodied, until we've gone through all the parts of the process, coming out of denial, making amends, understanding the ultimate purpose behind it all, the connection to spirit, forgiveness of self and other, and ultimately arriving in gratitude and empowerment. I think I will be doing what I can do to facilitate this because I think it's so important, and I think that the fierce intention that I've seen in so many people who were attracted to Andrew is a beautiful thing, and I think that it has the potential to have further impact in culture. And I think that the lessons learned from the ridiculous overstepping and the disregard for people's humanity are equally important for us to metabolize and incorporate.
That's right.
Well, thank you so much, Tom. Let me see. Maybe we should just, well, how do you end something like this? I think a bell. Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.